Welcome to the Scottish Football Coaching Podcast, taking you around the country, shedding light on the work of the Scottish FA from grassroots to coach development, and taking a look at the future of our game. On this show, Greg Patterson and Craig Joyce are joined by Phil Abbott and Michael Beale, co-founders of AcademySoccerCoach.com.
Guys, as you know, the podcast is all about Scottish football coaching. How did you two meet?
It was a while ago now, was it 18 years ago? 2001, I think. I was coaching, and just starting out, and I was coaching my son's team, grassroots. At the end of our street, there's a park, and they always used to train over there on a Saturday morning. We kind of realised that we wanted to break it up a little bit, and in terms of teaching technique and certain skills, you know, mastery of the ball, it wasn't necessarily something that we were any good at, or they wanted to listen to us. We felt that. So we reached out to Michael, who was a specialist skills coach at that time. And
was
Michael,
he not about 12 yeah. years old? What age was he?
Michael, you would have been, he was what? Early 20s. Early 20s, wasn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. So your Sam was probably his under sevens.
He was four at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. That's it. Never been able to get rid of Phil since. But no, it was obviously a big friendship's obviously built off that. Phil was one of the people that really supported me when I first started coaching. I used to go along and obviously coach his boys' team, and then some of his boys used to come to my the lads in the teams to come to the private classes. And then when I went into Chelsea, which was around the same time, Phil obviously came on board as a scout at that time as well with us. So yeah, we've been friends ever since then.
Were you still playing at the time when you?
I was still playing part time at the time. So I'd come away from Charlton as a professional and was playing in the Ryman League, which is probably about step five or six. So a couple of divisions outside of League Two, and I was mixing the two up, which was great for me.
How did you get into coaching, Phil? How did your journey start in the coaching?
Bizarre. Well, it started off with my son's team, and then it sort of migrated out to other teams as well. You get a real passion for it. Yeah, I think it's something you either love. You know, it becomes a real driver, a real love. Essentially, grassroots football. That's where I started. You know, and ultimately, I was very, very fortunate in terms of working with Michael, because Michael was a very very skilled, very, you know, the ability to feel a practice and develop a practice. Very, very good at recognising, you know, what the players needed, what they wanted, made sure the sessions were fun. Taught me a lot. You have a preconception. I thought I knew, it wasn't, I thought I knew as a player, when I played, I didn't play to a high level, county standard at best. But when you play the game, you think you know the game. Yeah. And it wasn't until I actually started going to my coaching courses that I realised that I knew very little. So
did you start the coaching courses at the same time you were coaching your son's team, or what came first?
Pretty much. I'd done my level one because I started coaching my son's team, and then took it forward from there.
I was very lucky. I'd been a young professional, and then I'd gone into having my own soccer school, and things moved very quickly for me. I think I had that for about 4 or 5 months, and then was very fortunate to get a job at Chelsea in the development centre, working with the 6s, 7s, and 8s, and it just moved very, very quickly for me. So, you know, I've run a men's team, I've worked in women's football, obviously worked in with grassroots kids via soccer schools, and working with my own soccer school. So I've had the mixed ability, which I think everybody needs to go through that. But no, I've had a pretty smooth route once I went into Chelsea. I was obviously there for a number of years. But to the side of that, I did AFC Wimbledon's youth team when there was a college programme, when they were first starting. Crystal Palace ladies, Chelsea ladies. All the time I was playing, coaching at Chelsea part-time. So I was doing, probably then, I was coaching 7 days a week. But it's never really felt like a job. It was a hobby that was like a huge love, so I had a huge enthusiasm for it. So I didn't ever really feel like I was working. I don't really feel like I'm working, you know, in the jobs that I've done in the last few years either. So it was just a huge passion, really. And I think everybody has to take different, different pathways on their coaching. If you're not a big name, then you certainly have to go out and knock out the hours. And I think that just it's all money in the bank in terms of your coaching experience. And you know, we all start doing the shoelaces up for the 5 and 6 year olds, and you learn there's certain skills to do that. I don't think now, if you're a player and you finish at 36, I think if you coach adults, you'll never be able to coach kids, in my opinion. I think if you start with kids and you work the way through, you learn certain skills that you need in terms of teaching. And I always think that I think I started in a nice way. I started at the bottom and went in that direction. And it's still probably my big love is still development. I get a little bit frustrated sometimes with the how harsh and how short-sighted senior football is. And I still think development is the purest form of work in football.
You started off, when you spoke previously, with your futsal.
Yeah.
How did that come about? How did your futsal come about? What made you think futsal instead of just going straight into football?
Well, I was lucky because I had a little bit of money left over when I came out of football. Not a lot, but I had a little bit, and I was probably 2 or 3 months not sure what career path I was going to go down. But I used it to buy the franchise of Brazilian Soccer School, which was quite big at the time. Simon Clifford was quite innovative in how he was. I didn't agree with all the things that he was doing, but he was obviously behind the film Bend It Like Beckham and Jimmy Grimble, and I just thought it was different. You know, obviously, Brazil being a huge influence on you when you're growing up, looking at the skill. And I quite liked the idea of the hard floor, the ball that didn't bounce. So I started, I bought a franchise of that, and I just started in a church hall and I was off and running. It was really interesting because, as I say, I was doing that, coaching at many other places as well. I was a postman for a while because every non-league player in London was a postman because you finish early and you can play in the evening. But you can imagine I was getting up at 6 to be a postman and then going to do college stuff, doing my after-school stuff, trying to play non-league, trying to then coach at Chelsea in the academy. And it was like, wow, something had to give. But I think that's what you have to do as a young person, especially, you know, I was 20, 21 when I came out of the pro game. A lot of my friends had left school at 15, 16 and they'd gone off and been tilers or roofers. They had trades, you know, they were very much 5 or 6 years into it. And I think that's a big issue now with a lot of young players in the game. You know, if it doesn't work out, they sort of come out at 21 and all of their achievements is in sport. They don't really have that, you know, that grounding behind them. So there's something you try to educate young players on now, for sure.
Did you ever think about going into futsal yourself, Phil? Was it, did that ever?
No, like Michael, I mean, time, you know, I was kind of, my background previously with my career was financial markets. So I worked in the City of London, I worked in the US for a while. I had 2 young kids. So I was a single parent at the time. So I didn't really have that, you know, it was the coaching was the passion. It was balancing family, balancing work, balancing, you know, everyone else, you've got to cover the bills and you want to pursue your passion with coaching. You want to see the boys that you work, young players that you're working with improving and developing as well. So, yeah, but futsal, I mean, I think we're on the academy soccer coach side, we're seeing it really, really grow. I mean, really, really grow.
So did you know you had that passion before the kids arrived? Or was it because of
I'd always played the game. Yeah. I coached as well.
Had you?
I coached a men's team before I became a father. But it was just, you know, it was I couldn't really dedicate the time to it due to work commitments that was warranted. Mm-hmm. You know, it was very difficult, you know, to balance, you know, when you're working in that environment, that city environment, finance environment, you've got to kind of, it's a full on, you work Monday to Friday and then most of the weekend you're doing your research, so.
Which is a good link as well into our last podcast, because we spoke in the last one with Andy Gould and Malky Mackay about
the visit to Chicago trip.
Of course, it was yourself that organised that for us.
It was a good day, right? I wish you could have seen it, part of me wishes you could have seen it 20 years ago. I mean, we're going off the football topic, but you can imagine 5 or 6,000 people screaming and shouting. It's like organised chaos. You know, but it was a.
But you say it's off the football topic, but the amount of comparisons we drew in that day, you know, you're talking about quick decision making, you know, being able to get on with peers, you know, you're in competition with others in that pit as well. There's a lot of comparisons to the draw.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, the ability to the visual aspect to see information and process it and act upon it before the other 500 people in the pit you're standing in, you're competing against them. Yeah, it's very, very competitive environment. So from that perspective,
I just keep thinking about Leonardo DiCaprio and Wolf of Wall Street, to be honest. Yeah. Just keep spinning when you're talking about the pack. Is it like that? Is it really like that?
No, it's not. It wasn't like that at all. I would that stuff went on. Let me know.
Close to what happens in the changing rooms in football. A wee bit of banter, a bit of...
From my perspective, yes, it was a great experience. But if everything I missed, you missed the people.
Is that part of the football as well, especially at the higher levels?
I think so. As you go through in football, football's such a... So I've got two sons now that are 5 and 7, and, you know, it's like Phil's young boy, Sam, who I first started coaching. Like, they're going to go on this journey. My boys do a little thing at their school with Stirling Albion. So I'm going to give a little plug to the coach there. He does a brilliant job with them. And so when they go through, they learn so much in the game, and you sort of gather so many friends through football, and you travel, and you have so many experiences. Now, I think... there's two sides. Obviously, there's the side where people can go and make a living in the game, but there's the other side where there's this lovely passion, which is for the majority of us, where you stay with the game because you love it all the way through. And I do think the characters you make... I'm in about 4 or 5 WhatsApp groups now, and it's people at different clubs, and, you know, there's reunions going on over here, and it might be a non-league club, and it might be the boys I played in the youth team back at Cholton in 96, 97. You know, staff groups from Liverpool, obviously... being away, obviously, in another country, you've still got a WhatsApp group of 3 or 4 people there, and then obviously the group that you're in now. So it just shows you how the game brings people together. Yeah. It is one of them games where, sadly, you do move to another club, and sort of the people you lived every day with before, you might speak to them once every 6 months now, but that's the one thing that pulls you together, the memories you have from the game. So it's a big thing, yeah. It's a real big thing.
Funny saying that, I'm looking around, and both of you have spoken about your kids. You've just recently started taking your kids in the morning. Do you ever want to step into sessions? I know it was a bit different for you, Phil, because you were taking the team at the time, but is there ever a time when somebody's coaching and you want to step in and say, that's no right, I've not got that experience yet, my wee girl's only one?
The guys have both spoke about the grassroots game, and as well as, you know, it's, I kind of do a little breakfast club when I can at my son and daughter's school, and I take their local team again, and it's you're trying to bring volunteers on a journey as well. You know, you've got to remember that those people are, you know, they're just starting. They're just starting in the grassroots game, and they're making the mistakes that we all made, you know, back then as well. But for me, it's just about letting the kids play. And it's as simple as that.
I can't emphasise that enough, that, you know, we're at a situation now where children are learning through watching the game on TV or playing it on their PlayStation or Xbox or whatever the young kids are doing now. So when they go out to play, they need to be playing, they need to be moving, it needs to be physical, because it might be the only physical activity they do that week. So, and they need to fall in love with the game, not practices that look like the game. I think that's huge in how we, you know, if a parent is taking a grassroots team, they're not a coach, they're a parent taking a grassroots team. They might then go on the qualifications, but if you can't coach, don't. The game's there for you. Facilitate the game as an adult in terms of giving some ground rules in terms of how you want the game to be played in terms of conduct, but then actually let the game take place. It is really a simple game. I like to sit back and observe. Sometimes, you know, I coach a lot myself, and so when I see other people coach, I actually like to sit back and observe, and you take ideas off of, like, the strangest coaches, or the, you know, in the scenario where you don't think you'd get an idea, you just get a little idea. And I think that's it. I think I like to just, when my children are playing, like, I'm only, it's really interesting because I'm a massive person on individual development. So when I watch my kids, it's a bit like when you go into the, you know, your parents even at school, you only really want to know about your kid. You know, so I don't get this thing of team when they're young, because when you go into the school and you want to find out how your young son or daughter's doing, you don't ask how the class is doing in maths, do you? You just really want to know, is your kid safe? Are they settled? And I think that then goes back to how open you are with parents. Because parents are like, they only want to know if their kid's okay. And parents, I think, can take honesty. You know, we're parents, we'd take honesty if our kid wasn't doing this or that. So I like just to sit back and watch my boys play and see what they like and they don't like. I've got to be honest, my wife drives me mad because she said, you never play football with them in the garden, you never do this and that, but I want them just to have their little journey with football.
I get that as well. Every night I go, why have you not taken the boys out to play? But, I sometimes think I might push it on them too much, because I spoke to you previously, Craig, about how my life becomes intertwined, and some of my family time is taking the kids to a game on a Saturday or a Sunday. It's taking them to, you know, and so it's all football. So I don't want to do that, Michael, you're right. I don't want to, as soon as I get in from work, let's get out in the back garden and play football. And they're going, football.
It's short time as well. You work in the game, so yeah. Full time, you know, it's difficult. It's a balance, right? Yeah. You don't always want to, sometimes you don't want to, you know, you want to switch off from football.
Running about, like lunatics is, yeah. You know, it's what Michael was talking about there. It's that, you know, it's physical activity of some sort, I think, yeah. Which will stand them in good stead.
Yeah, I think that's crucial now with young people. Safe play. How can we facilitate safe play, regardless of what sport it is, but safe play, because we probably all had it when we were younger, we'd just go out. I lived on a council estate where there was a lot of young kids, we used to just go out. So we had safe play, if you like, because we was allowed to do it. Now I don't think the children have it. That's the biggest dilemma with me with my boys, is finding something that sticks, something that can be their little passion. I think, the biggest thing is you don't want to force football on them just because dad does it, because they'll see it as a way of... So it's that thing of standing off. I've got to say, if there was a... You know, you look at the weather and the climate, and I'm not just saying that now because I live in Scotland, by the way. It's, you know, wherever you are, I think futsal and I think the indoor hall, it's a safe environment again. And I think if we can somehow remove weather in the UK from the development, we might get an upskill quickly in terms of technique. I found that in playing in the indoor halls with the futsal, because it was about the individual, so it was about learning something new. But you also, there wasn't the weather element, so it's quite a nice classroom. There's not the wind and the rain where you're rushing. They have that on the continent in many different ways. So I'm not advertising futsal. I'm saying that if you're living in Spain or you're living in South America or you're living in the African countries, the weather, the climate helps you in terms of practice time.
I remember Frank Coulson, Craig. Frank Coulson used to work in here at the Scottish FA. I think he was assistant technical director for Iron Frank. Used to go mad if people from abroad had maybe come over and done practices, and because of their natural climate back home, they might be a bit slower, and Frank would get impatient. You're not coaching the Caribbean now, come on. And there is this thing though, this culture we've got of trying to rush everything.
Yeah, I've lived that the other way, obviously, and the culture side of things is huge when you talk about. But I had that from previously when I moved from Chelsea to Liverpool. The speed of the training intensity at Chelsea was different at Liverpool, and I had to literally step back and think, were these kids actually working as hard? And they were. It was obviously just, there's a maturation difference, there's a different diversity in London to Liverpool. And I've obviously then seen that going and training in a different climate, where you want your session at as a coach in terms of intensity that makes you feel good. If the sun's beaming down, so... It needs to be more stop-start. How you manage them stop-starts is a skill. Likewise, if we go on now with Rangers, if we go on to an international break and we get to go somewhere like Tenerife, and last week we've been training in Glasgow, the stoppages you have in the sessions and stuff like that are different, just purely because of that. You know, them cultures then I've seen. If you're born in that country and you've only played in that country, them cultures are pulling you in two different directions. And then we see that at senior level when we watch the game, in terms of composure, in terms of maybe perception. It's all down to if you had two children that were twins and one went into one classroom and a teacher in there is quite up and at you, mm-hmm. and your other kid goes in another classroom and the teacher's quite calm. If they stay in that room for 10, 15 years, it's very interesting what comes out in terms mm-hmm. of your two children. And That's an interesting concept around teaching, I think.
You've made me very jealous of hot weather in Tenerife, to be brutally honest with you, because it's been horrible here, hasn't it, for the last couple of weeks. How did the academy soccer coach come about? How did you come up with that and kick it on just now?
It's a mad story, to be quite honest with you. I mean, there was actually... Mike, you were writing books, weren't you? Go on.
I was writing books, and Phil obviously was working in the city and had a lot of contacts, and obviously when you're writing a book you can write a scrap piece of paper to hand in or whatever, but you need a software to do it with. And and Phil had a big passion around coach education, like I did. Most of our conversations would be around coach education, so I want to be careful not to criticise any of the associations, but that was our big topic at the time, them years ago, was how the game's taught to the youngest players. Obviously, Phil was living it with his boy and coaching that age group. I was living it with different kids that I was coaching. So that was a big passion. And then when we first started Academy Soccer Coach, it was like, well, go on, if you're going to go and be a coach later on, how do you articulate yourself? So you might send a CV in for a job, but what's your, you know, what do you stand for? What's, you know, how do you want to coach? How do you present yourself as a coach, I suppose, was the big thing. And then coach education. If we didn't believe that the current route that the English FA was sending out at the time was right, because there was no youth modules, then how do we send that message quite strongly out there to as many people as possible? Going down the games route, facilitating the game and how you would... So it came from that. Phil went away, found some people to obviously build the original software. And then my big job was...
2006, wasn't it?
Yeah, and my job was to write the content, which was to really let the game be the teacher, which I think is a very loose term. To someone means something very concrete and they understand it, and to other people it can be quite dangerous, that comment. So we had to try and articulate that, but the ultimate thing was for the kids that we were coaching, the young ones, was they playing a lot? Was they getting a lot of touches? Was what they were getting relevant? How did you send messages? So Phil went away and had the software built so coaches could come on and play in their own sessions. So it was twofold, really. How do you develop young kids, but how do young coaches, because it's the hardest thing in the game, isn't it, as a young coach to get a break in the game. So I just feel that sending a CV in is maybe not enough. You have to present yourself slightly stronger than that. You have to try and build a, and that can expand. It's not set, but set preferences, how you want to play the game and how you want to coach it. So that's how it went. And it just took off, basically. It became something that both of us didn't really want it to become, because obviously Phil was working in the city and I wanted to be a professional coach. So this idea of this software going off and this going off somewhere, it became a bit of a monster that ultimately fell on Phil, if I'm honest, rather than myself. I sort of like drifted into sunset for a little while and carried on being a coach.
But you're always, coaching was your pathway, been brilliant. It's been, and will continue to be so.
What this software has enabled me to do is every single session plan, probably back from Chelsea under 9s and 10s in 2002, 2003, I have every single session plan, and I have it recorded in a nice way. Now I churn out a lot more session plans, so I don't always put it on the software, if I'm honest, but in terms of if I'm going somewhere and making a presentation, I can make a presentation look nice and people can take it on.
It's the visuals.
Yeah.
I mean, our intention was that we never actually intended to start a business. I needed the software I was doing for my badges. Michael was writing books as well.
Yeah, and it just sort of snowballed. It sort of snowballed from there, and a lot of coaches were like signing up across the world, and then they was asking a lot of questions. That's where I say it became a bit of a monster. But then it just shows you though that there is an audience out there of a lot of people that are working with the people starting out in the game, really young kids. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones with the most questions. They're the ones that are most curious. So it's clear that there's a huge passion for youth coaching. And really, if you think back to how we was first taught the game, you either taught it very well and your passion grows, or you're not taught it well and you become quite restricted in football, I think. So, you're talking about primary school kids, they think they can be astronauts or firemen or policemen, whatever they want to be. I think the coaches at that age group, their job is to make this kid feel he can be anything. For as long as possible, no limit, no layers laid on it, as long as possible. Then, you have the selection issue with professional clubs taking the kids young. But as we can keep our young kids believing they can be a superhero for as long as possible, they might actually go on to be a bit more free in the way they play the game. And so that there were some of the messages we were. Now, 17, 18 years later, I have a lot more experience. So some of the messages we maybe sent at the start were the right messages, but we can articulate it a lot better now, I feel.
I don't think, if you go back then, there wasn't really a mechanism where coaches at any level could communicate their ideas in a well-formed, professional-looking diagram easily.
Yeah, it was a lot of X's and O's, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So X and O's, if I'm looking at it, I still think, some people will need to see the session running in a video form, or they need to see it physically. But it was just a way of showing something a little bit nicer. And I think we've kept that ease of use. There's a lot of things out there that are, you probably needed a degree to be able to use. And then you've got to talk about the big thing now in academies is the amount of time coaches spent behind the desk. And if you're a parent grassroots, you've got a full-time job, as Phil had. So it's the ease of use was a big thing. I think that was the message in terms of more individualized coaching, what the young kids need, how do you get to each child in the group to make them feel good about themselves, and then the maximizing playing. Since then, there's been the emergence of the Youth Awards, which I think have been fantastic, and I think that's why in the UK we're seeing so much fantastic young talent come through, because we've made a conscious effort, I think everybody probably 10 to 15 years ago, to go down this route, to understand children a little bit more and to let the game be more prevalent in the sessions rather than technical drills, you know, combining the two. And I think that's what we're seeing, certainly in England, but I've seen it since I've been up here in Scotland as well. And you look at the Welsh team now, it's full of young players, it's vibrant as well. So you're seeing this come through. But I think the youth modules have been huge in terms of influencing coaches. And so it's nice to see that be taken onwards and upwards.
What was the responsibilities that fell on you then, Phil? If he rode off into the sunset and you were...
Michael looks after the technical content. Yeah. Let's put brackets around that. I basically ran the company. So myself, my staff, Chrissy, Matt, Susie, Sharon, Faye, our original North American director, Ricky, and he since left. New one, Jack, has come on board. It's just organising it as a structure that could hopefully at least look after itself, pay its staff, pay its way. But also, I mean, when we started, Michael referred to the first version, the first release of it. It was back in 2006. There was no App Store. There was no iPad. There was no iPhone. So, I mean, if you think back to how things have evolved over the last 13, 14 years, you know, it's incredible. And we've literally, the software basically, the original software has evolved to be able to be compatible with all these different platforms and devices. And we've, then we branched into coach education, made a big move into coach education and released the first, I think it was Northern, we worked with Northern Ireland and the first ever platform, digital platform for delivering their UEFA licenses and domestic coaching courses as well, referee education, tracking, then you had the implementation of CPD, that had to be catered for. So the whole thing's evolved. And we've literally just, in the process of, over the last 16 months, we've been building a new platform to bring ASC forward. When we started again and we worked with the pro clubs, we worked with Chelsea and Fulham and Arsenal, they didn't want their practices put on someone else's server. There was no such thing as the cloud. They wanted full control. So
I think them things are really interesting. It is huge to have a portfolio of your work personally, I think, to look back on. You know, we talk a lot about reflecting on sessions and stuff like that, and you look back at some of the players you might have worked with, and I think sometimes in football there's trends that come in and they come again. And if I can look back 8-10 years at what I was doing then, I can also see how I've evolved as a coach. I can also sometimes put myself back in line with my true values, because I can look back and my missus is always, or my wife is always, trying to get rid of them boxes. But them boxes are important, you know. Them folders have got every practice in, going back to maybe coaching a player like Ruben Loftus-Cheek when he was 7 or 8 in a development centre. Mm. And what was we doing then? And was it right? Was it not right? And they're good conversation. You go, you know, 13s, 14s, and, you know, you go up to Liverpool and then what worked here doesn't work there. But I think it's really important that you've got this portfolio of your work. You've done it. You've had to do loads of session planning. And I think that's important. I think that's important for all coaches to have that portfolio. And then presenting yourself outwards. I think that's really, really important, how you present yourself.
It's interesting as well, the fact that when you use technology, and it's a visual. The human brain processes visuals 400 times faster than and text. So, and football's a universal game, played the world around the world, but we all speak different languages. Yeah. If you can show someone a picture of what you want or what you're trying to achieve, there's a good chance they've got a better chance of understanding it. And we do, you know, we present, Michael has and I have as well, on some of the Northern Ireland's UEFA courses. And one of the things that you say is that you show them how they can use the software to support their pre-match prep. It's devising set pieces, and you always hear, you know, it's the power of being able, if everyone learns differently, so if you can show someone a diagram and you can communicate and hit their style of learning, or at least cover as much of it as possible, you know, with this additional resource, with an image, then surely there's a better chance for them to understand what you need. And if you understand as a coach at the elite level, if your players understand what you want, then you've got probably a little bit more chance of success than you would have if they didn't. So it helps. It's a supporting resource.
Michael, you keep talking about coaches presenting themselves better, and I keep I keep looking, and our numbers on coach education just continue to astound me. You know, if I was to look back over last year, we've maybe got, you know, 200 coaches doing a UEFA B license in any one year, which is astronomical for a country this size. Like, what kind of advice, I suppose, would you give those coaches? Because I keep saying to them on the first day of these every course, guys, you're one of 200 here. You know, it's almost treat it like a competition. You do need to be the very best you can be when you go throughout this course.
My biggest regret as a young player was I couldn't articulate myself. So when I had an issue, it would build up. I wasn't, as a young person, confident speaking to adults, so I couldn't go and speak to my coach and ask questions. And I think that might be something to do with the way that we teach, but I was certainly shy. You can see I'm not now. I talk for England now, but I certainly was shy. So I suppose what I talk to a lot of young players about, what's your identity? So, you know, when you're a young coach, if you come out and you start doing soccer schools and you've got 30 kids, you and one other coach, and there's 30 parents, there's a good chance a parent's going to want to talk to you. So you've got to be able to talk. But also, I don't want any young people in any walk of life to be scared to actually say what they want to be. So I think there's this big thing about being able to present yourself and saying, and you can be, arrogance is an interesting word. I'm not asking anyone to be arrogant, but if they've got a goal, lay down the goal and work the way back from it. So whatever it might be they want to be. And I think that's it. I really found it hard. And I used to a lot of things weigh on my mind when I was a young player that I wish I would have got off my mind. So now when I look back on it, yep, certainly I could have had better social skills. I think something in the teaching that was happening then in the schools and when you're coming through could have been less command and more the way it is now that would have brought that out of me. And that's what I feel about coaches presenting themselves. You know, what? Because there's no good or bad opinion in our game, is there? You know, we see it, you know, different countries play different ways, different teams within there. So it's what's right for your group of people, if you can get them to believe it and do well. So I don't think there's ever a silly opinion on the game. So I think that young coaches, in terms of presenting themselves, what do they like about the game? And how can they get that across to people? Instead of presenting it is, well, words are sometimes a bit more difficult than maybe pictures or having a presentation and what, and then how do you do the practices? I just think it's that self-being, you know, where do you want to go? A lot of the things that I'll talk about in terms of my coaching beliefs are actually teaching, guiding, education, development of young people. And I think that's the big thing. When I've got this real strong thing at the moment that we should never ever give a boy a scholarship at 16 if he can't tell you what he is or what he's trying to be. So if a boy, you know, why are we giving you this contract? Because we're going to give you this contract, you're going to leave the room, an agent's going to walk in there and he's going to ask for a king's ransom. But you can't tell us why you play. So are you a goal scorer, goal stopper, goal creator? Do you link the team together? What do you guarantee us in terms of, because we're about to give you a job. So a lot of 16-year-olds leave school and just go straight into a scholarship. They audition for it the last few years, but they never actually sat an interview for it. And so I think a lot of young football players are actually a little bit more immature than boys that go out or girls that go out into the real workplace and sort of have to have a bit of cold-faced learning. And I think that's it. What I'm saying about presenting yourself is it's not being a phony, it's not being a fake, it's actually saying, look, I love this about the game, and I love players like this, and I want to develop that, and having a real passion. So I think that's big in terms of self-development.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed that there. I get caught up in what you were saying there. I really did, to be honest with you.
The last few years, I've been lucky to speak a lot with school teachers. If you'd have said to me 10, 12 years ago that I would find myself as a youth developer or as a developer of players, I'd have a lot in common with school teachers. I'd have thought, but if where your full learning goes. So now I like talking to head teachers because I think they see a lot of kids go through. And just to have ideas, I was lucky enough to meet a guy who had been the head of the English school. He was in Qatar at the time, but he'd been in Paris and he'd been in Geneva as well. And he'd obviously been a head teacher at a very top school in England. And it was just fascinating speaking to him, you know, like just about, because a lot of what he values about this self-empowerment of young people and trying to get them to have an identity and what do you want to become and how do you work backwards was exactly the same as I was talking to players between the ages of 16 and 23, 24. Mm. So it's really interesting, this. I think obviously the youth are changing a little bit, how they learn and everything. And we've, as adults, if we're the ones educating them, we've got to be right at the forefront of it.
I think coaching courses, from what I've seen over the last 15 years, have embraced the teaching or the different learning style, the fact that the player, everyone learns differently, and the different methods in which you can approach that. Would you agree or not?
No, I think that's been a big... I think coach education's gone through the roof in terms of how it's improved everywhere. You know, everywhere. I see loads and loads of good practice going on, and that's why I say we're seeing it in our players. Our players at the moment in the UK, our young ones, are very expressive on the pitch. Mm-hmm. Probably as expressive as they've been. Years ago, we had very expressive players. We went through a bit of a lull. And I think now, when you see our young players break on, it's exciting. When you look at the national teams, you're seeing young players come through much more expressive. So that, therefore, we, as adults, we still want to improve that, but there should be a pat on the back somewhere, because we must be evolving everywhere. And that's because everyone's a bit more open-minded, I think. The big thing about team, I've said it all along, you know, there's no I in team. It's the worst saying in youth development. I get it at the senior level, performance level, but there is. If you're playing 7-a-side, there's 7. If you're playing 11-a-side, there's 11. So it's how you get in and make each person feel important, or actually how their role's important. What are you good at? How can you improve some weaknesses to make you even better at that? So if you're a goal scorer, what sort of goals you score? What sort of goals you miss? That sort of element of coaching now. And people think, oh yeah, but Mick, then it's only me taking this team on my own. Have I got to take little Johnny out on the side? No, you haven't. You can. There's a way of session planning, yeah, where you can get that across. And I'm talking about more in the youth development phase of secondary school. Yeah. Primary school, it's about playing and playing and playing and playing, combined with some very clever ways of teaching technique via challenging, competing. And I see so many people now that I can take little bits off, and maybe a few years ago I could see them influences overseas. I'm seeing them more and more now in the where we're going. I'm having some really interesting conversations in coach education. But the more we specify each child rather than the group of them, the better we're becoming. Simple. That's a huge message, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm kind of questioning, maybe talking myself out of a job here, but I kind of question at that. You know, you're talking about allowing the kids to play and play and play. I kind of question coach education, the word itself, coach. Does that encourage people to get in, to stop the game, to move people? And they don't necessarily need to, as you say, Michael. I think the game can become a teacher. I know that can be looked at in different ways, but, you know, if we give them the opportunity to play the game, you don't necessarily need to be a coach. You're almost like a leader, a helper, a facilitator, something like that, rather than this, I've done my badges, therefore I must coach. And it's, you know, sometimes the value in that is actually just allowing me to play.
I think you're a guide. I think that's what you are. The best coaches are a guide. You've got to be like, the younger they are, you've got to be like an older brother. Yeah. You know, like, I work now with senior players, and it's a collective effort, collaborative effort, because it's their team. We're suggesting and provoking, and we're maybe giving them a pathway that would help them be successful. But once they go over the line and the crowd are there and everything, it's very hard to get a message on. So how you teach, what you teach will help them. But when they're on the pitch, the fact that they can make decisions for themselves. So when do you want to start that process? You want to start it once they get into a team, or do you want to start it from right at the beginning? I think the first thing becomes self-understanding. What are you good at? How can you activate it in many different ways? And then learning to play with one player, two player, three players within the team as you grow. But I do think that coaching now, you're much more of a guide, and your communication skills, the art of one-to-one in communicating now is so important, I think. We hear a lot about, the game shouldn't be about money. Well, it depends. Your background could be different to someone else. You know, some of the boys coming from Africa and some of the less affluent countries and parts of the world, and even parts of Scotland, they need this. There's a need to be a professional football player, because it's a way out, it's a way of success, and it's a way of helping their family. That need for financial security is actually a lovely reason. I get what people are saying in another sense, but I think it's just allowing people to be themselves is a good way. I think, you know, when our kids go to school, that's why I say it's across all industries. When your kid goes to school, you want the teachers to allow your son or daughter to be what they want to be and help them along the way. I think that's really important when we're coaching, because the command style, I think at senior level and in some moments of the game is needed, but when you're guiding young players, I think you've got to let them try and be what they are or go up their own route, fail a little bit, come back and ask for help.
I was going to say, fail, yeah. You've got, that's how you learn, right?
Yeah, I think that's it. I think at any moment in my life where I think I've been doing well, I've been in a massive learning zone. When you're in a learning zone, you're exhausted by it, whether you're learning a language or you're working non-stop. When you actually sit back 2 or 3 months later, that was an amazing moment. I think, and that's what the game can do for you. But for that to happen, you were off, like there was no seatbelt. You were off on like a roller coaster of learning. And then your self-reflection is like, wow. So I think sometimes as coaches, we can be guilty of coaching something today that we want to be perfect tomorrow. You know, some of the teams, and I won't name the teams I work with, I know if we send a message 10 days ago, it will come out in 10 days' time. It's just something in another group, you can say it today and it will come out tomorrow, that can take it on. You sort of have to try and work that out with your teams quite quickly that you're working with.
It's interesting you saying that there, Michael, because with the team we're taking and at Glasgow City just now, we brought a young girl in. We had a game against the first team and it was just going to play, and she was like, but what do you want me to do? I'm like, go play. And she was like, what? And I was like, go and enjoy yourself, just go and play. It's a daunting prospect playing against the first team, but she was like, I've never been told just to go and play, ever. Like, never, ever. I've always been told I need to do this or I need to do that. And I said, that'll come later, just go and play then and go
and
enjoy it.
The women footballers I worked with was probably the best thing for me. I was obviously working with young children part-time at Chelsea, but I wanted to take my A licence. So I knew if I could take a women's team that played in the FA Cup, it was one of the criteria to go an A licence. So I was off and not away. Wow, they asked me so many questions, so many more questions than boys of the same age. Mike, why are we doing this? Why should we do that? Why? And it was like, wow, just a really huge moment for me. I'm so glad that I took that step because the girls at the same age, at them teenage ages or late teens, sort of early 20s, asked so many more questions. That was a really interesting part. We would say it now. So say if you have a young player break into the first team, when they first break in, everything's like, wow, I'm with the first team and I've got a smile on my face. So we try not to say too much because we try to keep it so innocent and happy for them. So try to keep them in that sort of youthful state as long as possible. So try to avoid having any real big conversation in terms of tactical. Try to keep it very simple on what's your identity, what you're very good at, why are you here, and just keep doing that. There obviously becomes a time when you have to have a crossover. But it's interesting that a boy gets to professional first team level and you're trying to keep him a boy as long as possible. It's quite interesting that.
And I know Don McNaughton, who does a lot on our, and he works at your club and he works at another couple of clubs as well, and he speaks a lot about that on our coach education courses as well. And I think, going back to talking about kind of how coach education is just expanding, it's no longer just about what happens across that white line. You're now looking at, you're discussing there, you've obviously pre-planned, pre-arranged how that transition is going to be. You've got that to consider. Is it psychological or is it leadership? Is it management? You've just got so many different facets of the game now to consider. And I think back to that kind of, I suppose, original question about those 200 going through the B licence, they might go off and be experts in different areas within the game.
I was thinking actually this afternoon, a friend of that was on my A licence back in 2003, 2004. He's now the technical director at Östersunds in Sweden. Mm. And someone else on the course went to work out in Azerbaijan. Mm. And so the people all over the place that were on them original courses. And it's huge, really, in terms of that. And they're they're like your best friends when you go on your first course. You talk about the game and the missing the change room. I've got a lot of friends that were on that level two I did down in the Kent FA, and then the UEFA B I did at the Kent FA. And because at the time, they're the sort of similar people that got a passion as you. And one of the guys that was on that course as well, he spent 14 years as a non-league manager. And I just saw last week, he's tweeted he's moving to another club. And so my career and his career have gone in completely different ways. But he was a fantastic coach, and he was someone that I shared so much with, your journeys and stuff like that. And so again, even on the coaches level, I would encourage people to get on the first course. Don't be apprehensive about it. Get on the first course. There's a lot of people that want to help you. There's a lot of tutors that want to help you. You might be in a little bit of in awe of, because they've obviously coached for a lot more years. But there'll be a lot of peers on the course that will pull you along the way. Yeah, sure. And I think that's really important, because there's a bit of strength in your journeys.
you know, and when I was doing soccer schools and working part-time, and you're young and you want to get more money, someone else might run a soccer school over there or might open a door. Once you get started as a young person, you won't ever step backwards. Just get started on it and just start moving forward. Because I think that there'll be a certain audience that would listen to a podcast like this, that they're itching to get started and a bit worried how. Yeah. Just sign up and get there. And then the people there, they're there to help you. And as I say, if there's 20 people on, you'll now have 20 peers that you can share stories with.
Our pro license recently, Frank Dick spoke on it, and he spoke about exactly what you're saying, turbocharger learning. You know, you won't just learn from the tutors, but you're able to turbocharge your learning from another 20 people that are in the room. And I just thought that kind of phrase was excellent, being able to, as you say, turbocharge and get what you can, and just that's you, you're away.
No, that's it's if you can. I mean, from my perspective, I was very fortunate. I mean, I worked with Michael, Michael coaching, and that, you know, you end up, if you like, you know, looking at that, and you start to you absorb that. You can't help but absorb that and the ways and mannerisms. I mean, I remember, it was a phrase that a young player received the ball, and Michael just very gently, softly went, "Relax." This is a young player, and that word just made it so. You could just instantly see the young player just relaxed with the ball, and the ball, you know, they were great. They were just, you know, it was an open space for them. You know, it was a blank canvas. Just express yourself. It's that one word.
It's quite an important thing as well. You're talking about the amount of coaches coming. There's different types of coaches. There's certainly different types of coaches. You know, so you can definitely be a tactician. So you can be obsessed with the X's and O's and where people stand and move. But you can be a real, you know, someone like, I was lucky enough at Liverpool, Steve Highway was around, coming back in working. His eye for technique made me feel uncomfortable. He has got that fine an eye for technique when he watches the game. I can't watch the game like that. It makes me uncomfortable. It makes me feel so inferior as a coach. But then I'll talk about that the game tactically, and he'll be like, "Oh, Mick." You know, because that's my big thing. Or I'm really passionate when I watch kids being coached that they're playing. Yeah. So there's facilitators, there's, you know, there's motivators, there's managers. There's certain people that are managers that are not coaches. They're not real tacticians, but they know how to manage people. And then there's so many other avenues now, whether it be in sports science, or whether it be in analysis, or scouting, or recruitment. All of them different things that make up the game. So, you know, when people come on, I think you've got to understand what sort of coach you might be, so what you really passionate about, and use that, and then try and round yourself off with the other little bits. But, you know, some people want to be Jose Mourinho, and some people want to be Guardiola, but some people will want to be Steve Highway, or they will want to be a fantastic youth coach. I think that's it. I think that's a big thing as well about, you know, when you come into coaching. I think now there's great opportunities to build a career as a youth coach when 10 or 15 years before there maybe wasn't. Mm-hmm. You know, that was very much a part-time career. I think now there's opportunities to become a full-time youth coach. Mm-hmm. Or a multi-sports coach, if you want to come, you're not specifying football, but there's so many avenues you can go. The big thing is getting yourself on that first course and moving.
Start the journey.
Yeah.
To round off what Michael was saying, I remember being, when we were at Chelsea, and they'd have these festivals, and you'd have European clubs come over, do you remember? Yeah. And I can always remember that the Ajax coaches were all ex-players with the youth teams.
Yeah, and it's kind of daunting that, because if you're not, you obviously look at that and think. All I would say to the young emerging coaches out there is, if a professional can come out at 36 and be a better field coach than you, then I would say they're a natural. If you've spent 15 years being a field coach and building up, or 10 years or 5 or 6 years, then they're a natural, which there will be in every field. I think what a lot of ex-players can do is they see the game, they get it. They get the vision, they can spot a player because they've been around them, they can manage a changing room, but then what you might bring to them is that idea of how to put it all together. And somewhere between the two of you, you'll get a fantastic learning, because he'll give you loads and you'll give him loads. And so it's interesting, I really applaud the players that have come out and gone into youth development first, because as I said, I think if you start understanding how people learn, and you start seeing how people develop and how they evolve, then when you're a first team manager or you're a senior coach, you can relate back to that. If you just go in the senior environment, I think young players could frustrate you and you might not understand the journey that they've been on to get where they are. There's a lot of things now in terms of, I think sports science is been a huge impact in the game. But some players can forget what they were at 17 and what the steps they had to make to become a fully fledged first team player and get their man bones. And I think that's all a part of the education. So, you know, recently Scott Parker went back in, didn't he, at Tottenham working. I know that Frank Lampard last year obviously went back into Chelsea, and Jody Morris, they spent their time developing. You know, even Thierry Henry was in at Arsenal. Obviously, Steven Gerrard went back in. I applaud the players for doing that, you know, going back into the clubs. I was very lucky in my time at Liverpool. A lot of players come back in, but it was a community club. As big a club as it is, it had a community feel. So you did have Robbie Fowler and Steve McManaman and Rob Jones and occasionally Carragher and Michael Owen coming in, and obviously Steven Gerrard coming back. So they were coming in and giving something back. Now, their knowledge, and you have to think, if Robbie Fowler's talking to your strikers about finishing and he's standing there and you're setting up the finishing practice, but as they come back, Robbie's just having a whisper in a boy's ear, that's huge. Yeah. So we can't have this, oh, ex-players get the jobs and we don't get the jobs. I think there's a place for everybody. I think that, but what I would say is, you'll have a lot of teaching skills and learning to be a guide that an ex-player won't have. He'll have a lot of things, intuition things that maybe comes from being in the game. It's binding the two together. In every football club now, you'll have an ex-player maybe as a manager or a coach, followed around him by a lot of academics, sports science, analysis, medical, and it's part of tapping into everybody's expertise, isn't it?
Yeah, so, well, in business, you know, you can read any, Alan Sugar, Richard Branson, you can read any business novel on. The idea is that you've got to be able to, you know, surround yourself with smart people. That's people that know more than you do in certain areas that you need that knowledge, you know.
Touching on the journeys, and you both touched on it a wee bit there, how did your journey pan out then, Phil? You started off in the coaching. Did you ever think to yourself, I want to go and kick on, I want to be a coach at the level Michael's at just now?
I was happy working at a lower level, grassroots, sort of, you know, high level youth, but not academy. I was happy to work outside of that. You know, and also, you know, at the end of the day as well, academy soccer coach had taken off to such a point whereby it needed to be managed. You know, and I would never have, still needs to be managed. Yeah. But if I'm honest, I've got a lot of pleasure personally. As Michael's my pal, you know, although we started this thing together, he's my pal. And It's been good, fantastic for me to see him on his journey and share little bits of it with him and just see him moving forward. It's been great. And I also know you surround yourself with good people, right? Well, I know for a fact that there are players that Michael coached that have gone on to become professionals. When he coached them when they were 8 and 9, and they will still call him, and their parents will still call Michael. And I think that says a lot. So you look at that and you think, you know, that's brilliant. Yeah, that's wonderful. It's the mark of a man, you know. So, and from my perspective, I enjoyed coaching. I got to a point as well where my daughter was dragged all over London, south, west, north, east, in all kinds of weathers. And this is quite ironic, really. And then on last week, I got a phone call. She doesn't live at home, and she's working. She's 20. She's with a young man. I got a phone call from her. She said, "What are you doing Sunday, Dad?" I wasn't planning on doing a lot. I got back from overseas sort of in the week. Do you fancy coming over to our local park? My boyfriend's got a game of football. It was sideways rain, blowing a gale, and I've gone up to her and I'm going, it's as if we never moved. It's like you're 5 years old again.
I like the bit about the pals as well, because they're important. That's probably why we're sitting across the table. It's like pals here, innit? You're smiling at me. You sent me a picture of a love heart drawn around it a couple of weeks ago as well. Absolutely loved that.
If you're looking at the white, you can't see the whiteboard now, but it's got.
To be fair, I send Michael in pictures all the time, my love heart running, but it's. What about your own journey, Michael? What, did you expect to be where you were? It was all something at the back of your mind that you were going to get there?
I was a young Chelsea fan. I wanted to be Jose Mourinho. He came to Chelsea. Started out in coaching, and I wanted to make up for disappointment not being a fully fledged professional. I obviously had a bit of time as a reserve player, so I had that hunger to make up for that. And then I just felt at 40, I'm going to be a manager. And that's what I thought at 21 when I really started coaching full time. I thought I'm going to be a manager and I'm going to knock down every wall, go on the courses, and I'm going to be a manager. I've just turned, I'm 38 now. I don't feel like that anymore, that I'm chasing, because obviously I achieved some things I never thought I would achieve quite quickly. If you'd have said to me back then, I would have been a youth coach somewhere, an under-18s coach. That's an incredible job to get at any club. It's the best job in any club. You know, you have the lovely working week, you play on a Saturday, everyone respects it, the managers come and watch. That's the one job I've not done. It's the job that I still want to do one day in the future. So to get to work full-time at Chelsea was a real big thing for me. And I got that just through work ethic and passion, I think, for coaching young players. It was a big thing to move to Liverpool when I moved there. It was the right move to make, because I was chasing a bit of unanswered questions. I felt I could have ended up being too comfortable at Chelsea. So go on then, let's go to the other end of the country and see if I can get the Scousers, who are very proud people, to accept me as a Londoner. That was a real big challenge, but also it was a hugely famous club, and what, you know, it's the best thing I ever did. And there was some trying times at the start. We just had a child and we was living away from home, me and Roxanne. My dream when I also started out wasn't just to be a manager, it was to be a manager and be a manager abroad. And my big influence on that was Terry Venables and Bobby Robson. I didn't feel as British coaches we were respected at the time. Everything was better than us. The players were better than us. The coaches were better than us. Things are still similar, but they're starting to change. People are listening now. But then that was a huge thing. So when I had the opportunity to go abroad, I never thought it would be as far as it would be, Brazil. But I had to take it. I just had to take it because it was a sort of challenge I'd set myself 15 years earlier or 14 years earlier. Although I knew that I probably had at Liverpool under-23s, with everything that was around me at the time, in terms of the freedom I was given, the staff above and sideways, it was probably the best job I was giving up that I would ever get. I had to keep chasing that. I've stopped chasing a little bit now because I feel quite happy in the role that I'm doing. You know, when I came home from Brazil, I was lucky enough to go straight back into Liverpool, which was one of the reasons that it was easier to come home. And then I never thought, if I hadn't have gone back to Liverpool and I took a bit more of a sabbatical and took time out to sort of assess everything, then I would never have come to Rangers. Because when I left to go to Brazil, the guy that was taking the 18s moved to the 23s and Stephen came into the 18s. Okay. And then when I came back to oversee some of the younger coaches and mentor them, that's when I got to know Stephen a little bit, but only a hello and a sharing of ideas and sat around a table like this occasionally. There was no friendship. Mm-hmm. But it's amazing. If I'd have took 6 months out, which was my first plan, and the academy manager at Liverpool nagged me a bit to go back in, which was only supposed to be part-time, then led to full-time, I wouldn't have come where I am now. So this is crazy, really. I just took a couple of gambles and you end up. All that time, I would say it's never been a job, it's been a huge passion. And I've made a lot of mistakes along the way. And I've made some broad statements along the way that were really wrong, because that's part of growing, isn't it? The game's like this and then it goes like that. And I've got a real passion now for youth development. I work at senior level. My clarity on youth development now is so much stronger. Just having that experience of going to South America, having the experience of working in London, having the experience of working in Liverpool, women's disability, grassroots, mixed ability. Mm-hmm. The clarity it's given me is huge. And so my passion is youth development. But if we take the word youth off development, because I work with some young players now, I say young because they're 25, 26 and I'm 38, so they're young. They're developing and evolving and getting better every day. So just, we need to take the word youth off of development. If you're a developer or a development coach, you understand development, you'll work every age group. You'll work through. And I think first team coaching now is going that way. We're less and less sheepskin coat managers, old school managers. We're much more now universal coaches that have got an idea about everything. They know what they're strong at and then they bring the people around them. So that's like collaborative coaching, which is what I'm saying you do with the players. And yeah, I think what's really kept me in good stead, if I'm honest, I started off as an individual coach. Futsal was very individual, ball each, skills. and I'm pretty much known for being a good individual developer now. That's what, if you said to me, what are you, Mick, your tactics? And I'd say, no, I'm good at developing individuals. I can do a bit of that, but that's my, it's amazing because I started there, that's become the trend. I've been very lucky because that's how I started. If I'd have gone down.
Is it luck? I was a hard graft, and you know that vision that you've spoke about before. I've heard you speak before about that vision you've always had, and stepping outside your comfort zone. All those things. It's not just solely luck, surely.
No, I think I try to have a thing for that for young players now and for coaches. It's like I call it you versus yourself. And then Frank Dick, as we were speaking about earlier, has got that lovely video, and he's at the side of the running track when he says about that's. I use that in presentation because that's you versus yourself in the most simple form. Basically, it's like not looking sideways to compare, only for inspiration. Because people will get there. If I was obsessed with being the youngest manager, you know, to be a manager, and someone else gets there before, I'm going to stop going to work. If I'm, you know, if I wanted to be somewhere at a certain time, I won't. So I could look somewhere sideways for inspiration all the time, but not to compare. Because I think, and I'd say that to young players. So if my big thing was, I'm not satisfied. People in my private life, my family, might, you know, always telling me, slow down a bit, Mick. Mm. But that's the thing that keeps me going. So I wouldn't advise it for everyone, but it's a good thing for me. You know, I think I was, the reason I say I was lucky is I went into Chelsea at a really lovely moment. They had 9 first team managers that were world famous. They had a lot of top players. I was lucky enough to see Ian Robin train at 19, 20. Mm. And that was unbelievable to watch him train on his own at the end of the session. Just stay out and work. And then there was a lot of good youth coaches there at the time as well that were talking very well. So I was lucky to be in them conversations. And the one thing I would say to anyone coaching is that you don't know. I'm lucky enough at the moment I get to walk out Ibrox and it's full. Every time you go there, you don't know. The days are counting down every time you go there. So you take it in. I look back to them and then conversations back then, and we had your Paul Clements, your Steve Hollands, your Steve Clarks, Neil Barstow, the academy manager, Brendan Rodgers. We had some fantastic coaches when you look 10 years on now. They were all sat having breakfast on a Saturday morning talking about youth development. So that was quite, and then you go up to Liverpool and you have good people there. So although I think I've had to work hard and I've had to obviously be good at the job and expand at the job, I do think sometimes you're in a situation where you're taking all this in and something comes out. I still think when you stand in front of players of any age, your personality, and the fact that you have to understand what they want. I think it's hard to come training every day at 10:30 and want to play football every morning at 10:30 and be happy about it if the face that's in front of you don't understand that everyone's different and have things going on. Likewise, when you go into a grassroots team and they're training one day a week and you've got this fantastic practice you want to do, but these boys and girls just want to play the game, how do you merge the two? So what the player wants to do and what you feel they need to do. Mm-hmm. That's the real art, and that personality to put it across. Absolutely. I think huge.
You touched on the abroad part there. What was it like for yourself going over to America as part of the stock exchange?
It was a great experience. Yeah, it was a great experience. Apart from the fact that, of course, that I have to say everything twice because they think I'm Australian. But, it was brilliant. Very, very fortunate. Very, very fortunate. And on, you know, and since sort of ASC's grown and developed, I think we work with coaches in around about, I think it's about 56,000 coaches in about spanning 162 countries, and we've been very fortunate. With the people we work with, we aside from the pro clubs we work with national associations. Obviously, we work with yourselves. We work with the US women's national teams. They've won 3 World Cups. The technical director at the time, April Heinrichs, her staff, April Cater, Annie Frias. You know, we've been very, very fortunate with the people we work with at a high level. So you get to meet these people, you get to understand them, you build relationships with them, and it's the relationships that are important.
The game's seen differently. For example, when I worked in Brazil, you could never make a backward sub. Well, I mean, you could never take a number 10 off for a holding midfielder to see a game out, regardless of the score. You'd get whistled at. And so you do, different parts of the world do see the game differently. I think in America at the minute, they've not cut corners, but they've definitely at the forefront of sort of sports science. So they're very robust in how they play the game, and they're trying to couple that with, and
It's definitely progressing.
Yeah, and other countries will value other parts of the game, certainly. And so the cultures are really important. And sort of understanding people and cultures is huge if you're going to work at a good level, because as we see here in the UK, if you work at senior level, you walk in the changing room, there's people from all over the place, which again is completely different to the generations past. So them guys, the famous managers of years gone past, can certainly advise you on some things, but you know, they're fascinated to ask you what it's like to have this multicultural, where you've got to understand that you might have to treat a South American slightly different to a guy from Scotland, slightly different to a guy from Ireland or wherever. I think that's a big part of it. And to now, managers got to be so open-minded, because they'll have their own culture and inbred values they want from every single player. That's huge culture.
And also, the other thing we've noticed as well is that every country has got their own challenges, where they're demographic. Yeah. I mean, I'll give you an example. Like in Canada, the challenges they've got to produce, they've got a very, very strong women's game. But for the men's game, Jason DeVos has stepped in as technical director, and they've recently appointed John Herdman as a national team, who is an exceptionally impressive person. I mean, I was super impressed with him when they had a soccer summit over there a couple of weeks ago in Ontario, and he gave an hour and a half on stage, and he was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. So, you know, the 2026 World Cup, where they're co-hosting it with Mexico and America, and you know, look out for them, because I think, you know, if he was extremely impressive.
He's had a very interesting background. So I believe he's from Newcastle, is that right?
I kid you not. Yeah, he was from that part. He's a Geordie, and he was you had the soccer schools, Brazilian soccer schools. He had the North East franchise.
Really? Well, that's interesting, because he's obviously been the women's national team coach.
Yes, that's right.
And now become the men's. And obviously he's got Scotty Arfield, obviously plays for us, and young Liam Miller, who we had at Liverpool, who scored his first goal for Kilmarnock last week. So you're talking about pathways there. There's someone not too far from where we are now, and he's gone on this huge journey to end up in Canada as the women's national team coach and the men's national team coach. So it just shows you. He's not had that playing background, but he's managed to go on and have it, and that's important.
Yeah, you know, the challenges. I mean, you could be on an airplane. I mean, the travel commitment they've got. I mean, you can be on an airplane, a jet plane in Ontario airspace for 3 hours and still be in Ontario airspace. I mean, that's, we'd be in Cyprus or something.
That's a derby.
Yeah,
that's a derby.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
We'd nearly been Tenerife by now.
Yeah.
We'd be there, boys. I'm conscious of time and you guys are busy, so who was your influences coming through?
From a coaching perspective, I would have to say Michael for me, as a coach. I was very, no, seriously. I was very fortunate to watch him.
I'm not paying for dinner tonight.
No. but in terms of business, and I would say probably the most important thing to me was to be a good dad. And I had a very, very good role model. I lost my dad last year. And you don't realise it, but he was kind of, all of the time you're growing up and, you know, he's running you here, there, and taking you to football, he's actually drawing you a roadmap of how to be a father, how to do it yourself. Yeah. You know? And it wasn't until, you know, you have your own children that you actually realise that. So I'd have to say, you know, without a shadow of a doubt, the biggest influence in my life has been my father, 100%.
Yeah, similar to Phil. I think, you know, when your parents are bringing you up, they're strict in some moments, and they allow you to move in others. It's a bit like the role model of being a coach, like we're saying, as a guy. My grandfathers were very influential as well. I had one school teacher that was very interesting, because I was quite a talented young player, but he made me take responsibility. So I had like the job of picking the school team, and then who was going to play where, and he provoked me with these questions. So I think he's the one that probably gave me responsibility to being talented, which I think was very, very interesting. And then without naming any young players, because still emerging, you come across a player, you think you've seen the level, and you come across a player and they just break down all the barriers. And then you know what? You take a big deep breath and you don't want to let that kid down. So then as a coach, you have to rise your teaching and your level and the experience you're giving them in the session for them. I've had that. I've had that on a number of occasions, and them players remain nameless, but you're forever grateful, because you don't talk about standards of the game and knowing the level and knowing the standards. I've had a few players do that to me, and a few experience who have gone, okay, I'm not going to let this child down because his ceiling is so high. So I've got to make sure that I provide stimulus to him because he's really, really talented. And I've been lucky that first started at Chelsea and then obviously in Liverpool. And then what I saw in Brazil in terms of the need of playing the game, wow. I've now come back and I am that person who sort of promotes that a lot to young players in the UK. Like, there's kids out there that they need to be a player. It's a different motivation in terms of practice. And but what a fantastic game, because we can talk about it till the cows come home.
Yeah.
I think this is what young people need now. They need someone to actually not give them every answer, just open the door a little bit, because people are desperate to walk through it. And I think that's it now, especially the school leavers. You know what I mean? How do we grab school leavers? How do we make them, before they leave school, probably speak a little bit stronger? And because I think that's it. Them people that in our life have been a big influence on us, it's how they made us feel and what they made us do. So they made us feel something inside, and then it might be that they never let our standards drop, or they made us strive for the best, or they made us reach for the stars, but it's how they made us feel and what they made us do. So there's loads of people out there that can do that, and it's not time consuming to a young player or a young kid that's leaving school, just to help them on their way. Because as you say, it is so influential. It's like we can look back and pick three or four moments in our life where if someone hadn't have done that, so if Damien and Matthew hadn't given me my first job at Chelsea, you don't know. You might have been stuck in the soccer schools and give it up because you couldn't see a pathway. So it is huge, I think.
And it's not just in football, it's life.
Yeah.
Those doors need to open in life.
Yeah, and I think that's why the term guide's quite a nice term, especially with the way that coaching's going, being a strong guide for young players, because they will come back to you, because they'll have a track. If you've been a strong guide and you've done it right and they feel safe with you, when they're at another club or when they're not playing football and they have a problem in their life, they will come back at some stage. Do you know what I mean? I think that's it. We're trying to, in youth development, empower. We're trying to take them from being very dependent on adults to being very independent people. That's it. We should never forget that.
That's all we have time for in this week's edition of the Scottish Football Coaching Podcast. Feel free to send us your feedback, your ideas for coaching topics you want us to cover, and to get in touch, visit @ScottishFA on Twitter or email info@scottishfa.co.uk.